From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, post-election conversation and analysis. First, a live conversation with Iowa's governor-elect, Republican Terry Branstad, who handily defeated incumbent first-term Democratic governor Chet Culver. Then in our second half hour, Bob Vanderplaats and the president of the State Bar Association join us with their differing views on the ousting of three Iowa Supreme Court justices in yesterday's retention vote. We'll also get analysis this hour from Dennis Goldford, professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Governor-elect Terry Branstad live in discussion following this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today, of course, some post-election conversation and analysis. In just a few minutes, we'll get analysis from Professor Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Then in the second half hour, contrasting views on the ousting of three Iowa Supreme Court justices in yesterday's retention vote on the ballot. But first, he's back. That's the declaration of one newspaper headline this morning. Joining us now, former governor, now governor-elect, Terry Branstad. Last night, Iowa voters elected Branstad to a fifth term as governor. He defeated first-term incumbent Chet Culver by 10 percentage points. Good afternoon to you, Governor-elect Branstad.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the vote of confidence I received from the people of Iowa yesterday. We are looking forward to hitting the ground running and focusing on jobs and revitalizing Iowa's economic development plan and also improving our performances in education as well.
So your very top priority is jobs, the economy, when you get into office.
Right. Absolutely. We have the highest unemployment in Iowa today that we've had in 24 years. I know we can do better than the status quo. I want to really replace the discredited Department of Economic Development, where you've had, I think, five or six of the top people either fired or quit, with a new effective public-private partnership. I want to put the right-to-work law back in our marketing material. I want to make it easier to start a business in Iowa. I want to reduce the commercial property taxes and the corporate income taxes. And I also want to make sure that Iowa is competitive. And I will be very hands-on involved, directly working to help encourage businesses to locate, expand, and grow in Iowa.
Governor Branstad, you've been in this position before, this transition period, after you were elected for the first time as governor in 1982. What are the keys to making the transition a success?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to do budget hearings and know the details of the budget so we can set priorities. I made a commitment, and I think the people all across this country said, we've got too much government, it's too efficient, it's too costly, too inefficient and too costly. We can't afford to keep rolling up a bigger debt and deficit for future generations. I'm committed to having the state spend less than it takes in each year and reducing systematically and thoughtfully over a five-year period the size and cost of government. So the first thing we'll do is work on budget. And by doing that, we will analyze and review everything in the budgeting process so we can have more of our resources focus on priorities like education and public safety.
Speak more to the transition from a Culver administration to a Branstad transition so that that is smooth and so forth.
I've already appointed David Roeder, who's a former chief of staff for me, and he's worked with Chambers of Commerce all across the state in recent years as a consultant to be in charge of our transition team. Also, my campaign manager, Jeff Boink, will also be a deputy for the transition. Tim Albrecht, who's my communications director, will also work on the transition. And we intend to be reaching out to a lot of people in this process. And obviously, we want to do everything we can to make it as smooth as possible. And we're also looking forward to working with the new legislature. And we're very excited about the new leadership that's coming into the House of Representatives. And we intend to work with both the new Republican House and the Democratic Senate.
Let's talk about that as pertaining to one issue. Prior to the election, you said you did not support the state's free preschool program because you view it as an entitlement. You've said you support giving state assistance for preschool based on need. How do you plan to go about changing this program, especially with the split in the Iowa legislature?
Well, we need to have something that's affordable and sustainable for the long term. And what happened is started this new entitlement program, and then Governor Culver did a massive across-the-board cut. Since education gets 60% of the budget, we saw teacher layoffs, we saw furloughs, and we saw a huge property tax increase because schools had to use their cash reserve and then raise their levy to replenish that cash reserve. And I want to assure schools of stability and predictability in funding for K through 12 education, and I want to target the resources for preschool. I want all four-year-olds to have access to preschool, but my family and many others have paid tuition for preschool for many years, and I think those that can afford it can pay tuition. Those that can't, we should provide financial assistance, just like we do in the hot lunch program.
So, but how do you do that, given this split between the House that will be in GOP hands and the Senate still in Democrat hands?
Well, first of all, I've worked in that situation before. I was governor before I had the legislature controlled by the other party for 10 years, and then I had a split legislature for four and a Republican control only for two of the 16. So I've worked in that situation. In fact, I found it to be a place where in the years 1993, 4, 5, and 6, we accomplished a lot with a split legislature. I'm confident we can do that again. I think the margin is going to be close enough in the Senate that we should be able to get collaboration and cooperation with them. And I think also we have to live with the means we have. We're not going to raise taxes. Instead, we're going to reduce the cost of government. We want to focus the resources on providing the best education we can, meeting the needs of K through 12 as well as preschool. And the way we're going to do that is not make it a free new program that we can't afford, but instead target the resources to the families that have financial need.
If you just joined us, former governor, now governor-elect Terry Branstad joining us live from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. A couple more questions, Governor. Thank you for coming in today. Last night, Iowans voted to oust three state Supreme Court justices who were up for retention. These were justices who were part of the unanimous ruling paving the way for same-sex marriage in the state. Bob Vanderplaats led the effort on retention. We'll speak with him in the second half hour. He said it would put pressure on you to issue an executive order forbidding same-sex marriage until Iowans have a chance to vote on a constitutional amendment. Will you issue that executive order?
Well, I know of no state that has done that. I don't know any legal precedent for doing that. A governor does not have the authority to override a Supreme Court decision with an executive order. In fact, I remember when Governor Vilsack did an executive order on the subject and was challenged by then State Senator Steve King, and Steve King was successful in having that struck down. So I want to do things that are constructive. First of all, I think the people of Iowa have spoken loud and clear, rejecting an activist court. I think we now need to look at where do we go from here. And I want to restore credibility to the court and the judicial nominating process. We have an unbalanced situation today. The Judicial Nominating Commission that nominates people for consideration of the court is dominated by one party, 12 Democrats, only one Republican. That's not right. It's not fair. I think Iowans would want to see a balance. It was not supposed to be political, but it covertly has become very political, and I think we need to correct that situation or we're going to have a real constitutional confrontation on our hands.
Governor Branstad, and finally, how does it feel, this victory? How does it compare with your four previous gubernatorial victories? Does it get sweeter with time?
Well, it's a bigger challenge because the state of Iowa has some big financial problems to deal with, but I'm excited about it. I feel much better prepared than before, having been the president of Des Moines University. I've worked with doctors and with academics, and I think if you can build consensus and accomplish things with doctors and academics, you can do it with the legislature and with the other folks of the state. So I'm excited about it, and I'm very honored and pleased that the people have chosen me to be the new governor of Iowa at this critical time in our state's history. And as I said last night, we're going to give it heck for 4 years. We're going to work hard every day. Kim Reynolds and I going to all 99 counties, listening to people, putting together the best, most talented administration we can to meet the challenges of jobs and education and restoring economic development. I mean, not only to economic development and education, but also making sure that we're spending less than we're taking in each year.
Former governor, now governor-elect Terry Branstad, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Governor-elect Terry Branstad live in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day here on Wednesday, the day after the 2010 midterm elections. Joining us for the rest of the hour and also in the studio at Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines, Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Good afternoon to you, Dennis.
Good afternoon.
Former Governor Terry Branstad beats incumbent Governor Chet Culver 10 percentage points, the margin. What is the campaign narrative that led to the defeat of an incumbent by such a wide margin?
First and foremost, I think it was a Republican year, generally in terms of voter dissatisfaction with conditions in the state, conditions in the nation, number one. Number two, Republicans, after hitting the depths for a while after the 06 and 08 election, both statewide and nationally, came roaring back this time. And I've always said that at least what I'm told about real estate people is the three most important factors in real estate are location, location, and location. In electoral politics, it's turnout, turnout, and turnout. Mm-hmm. So Republicans were just chomping at the bit, raring to go, either in early voting or in voting yesterday. Democrats sort of fell into a kind of Hamlet mode, to vote or not to vote. That is the question.
Back to the governor's race. Compared to many other states, it is true, of course, that we've experienced a deep economic recession. But in the midst of that, Iowa not doing too bad when compared with other states. In fact, as Culver brought up many times in the campaign, Iowa ranked third best run state in the nation. Why didn't this message resonate with voters? It's bad everywhere, but Iowa is not as bad as most of the other states.
Well, you know, there's an old joke in statistics. If I stick one arm in a fire and the other in a freezer, statistically I'm comfortable. And of course, we know I'm not. No matter what the numbers say, what matters is the lived experience. And Governor Culver was able to point to a number of different metrics, a number of different measures suggesting that Iowa was in decent shape or not in as bad a shape as we found in other states. But that wasn't penetrating and resonating in the lived experience of a significant number of Iowans. So, our neighboring states could be worse off, but that doesn't really make it any easier for people in Iowa to pay their mortgages and buy their groceries.
Dennis Goldford with us, professor of politics at the university, at Drake University. Listeners to The Exchange, we'd like to hear your thoughts, your questions this day after the 2010 midterm elections. How do you feel waking up this morning in light of the election results? Will the candidates elected in Iowa and nationally bring about change you want? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook as well. And let's talk a little bit about the congressional races. All of Iowa's five congressional districts remain in the hands of the incumbents. Tom Latham, Steve King, having no problem whatsoever in the 4th and 5th districts of Iowa. Much closer races, though, in the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Nevertheless, Bruce Braley, Dave Lobsack, Leonard Boswell coming out on top, the incumbents in those races. How did these three manage to hang on when so many other Democrats lost their seats in this massive GOP takeover of the House?
Well, even in an anti-incumbent year, and I think that term was overused, as we certainly can see here in Iowa with our congressional delegation, including Senator Grassley. But incumbents have a distinct advantage over challengers. They have better name recognition. They have the chance to be relatively well financed. I mean, in the governor's race, we had the oddity that the challenger was actually simply a former incumbent who didn't have that problem of name recognition and campaign funding. You had a situation, of course, as you said, no danger for King and Latham. In the three Democratic districts, you had incumbents who had been through tough races before, And they did have, especially in the Braley race, a lot of outside money, well, a lot of independent money dumped into that race. He was able to hold off that challenge. It's tough if you're a challenger and you're just coming in and not relatively, you're not very well known. Mm-hmm. So those were certainly tough races. Boswell, at least the last I looked at the figures, had the toughest race, but he always has a tough race. But Zahn wasn't the best candidate in the world in terms of being deft on his feet and being able to deal with some of Boswell's challenges and advertising. If anything, I thought, yeah, the Braley race and the other Loebsack race and the Boswell races were the races of greatest vulnerability for the Democrats. But through a matter of hard work and some good fortune, they were able to pull them out.
Talk more about the role of this anonymous money, this anonymous corporate money that flowed into this campaign. You mentioned the Bruce Braley campaign. He had that as a headwind otherwise prior to the Supreme Court ruling. Wouldn't have had that. Is that a game changer from here on out? Is this a milestone this election that we will be figuring that in to future elections as well?
Well, you know, our political system runs in such a way that it's oftentimes not what message you hear. Rather, it's how often do you hear the message. And that costs money. We're a big country. Our advertising tends to go on television, at least the broadest range of advertising. And that's very expensive. And in 1976, in the case of Buckley versus Filio, one of the first major campaign funding Supreme Court cases, the court essentially said, to paraphrase, that money is speech. And so you have a constitutionally protected right under your right of free speech in the First Amendment to donate money, to contribute money to candidates. Well, the question was always, of course, how do you deal with this? Our system is such that, the more money you can bring to bear, the better you're off. Although I would say that money is a necessary but not sufficient condition. You've got to have enough money to be competitive, but the money alone won't guarantee you a victory.
Mm-hmm. We saw that in many races across the country.
Absolutely.
In fact, I wanted to ask Meg Whitman as a case in point. Over $100 mm-hmm. million, dollars, wasn't that true?
$140 million of her own money, by all reports. Yeah, I mean, that's just astounding. But California, of course, is an immensely expensive media state. Mm-hmm. But the fact she was so competitive was because the money gave her that platform.
But also, can the money, if you're backed by this big money, be it Meg Whitman, your own money, or this anonymous corporate money, in the case of Bruce Braley being attacked with that money, can you actually turn that to your advantage and say, listen, there is this faceless corporate money I'm facing, and you can look like the underdog and make the other person seem kind of sinister because they have no name, they have no face, they have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to do that with skill. You're right. You can do that, but you've got to be able to do that. And I think the Braley folks, I'm not in the Eastern Iowa media market, so I didn't see a lot of that firsthand. They may have been able to make an issue of that, but even statewide with the issue of judicial retention that you talk about in the second half hour,
right,
there was a lot of out-of-state money that came in, and the pro-retention forces really didn't make as big of an issue of that as they could have or should have from their perspective. So you're precisely right. That's there as a vulnerability on the part of the people who are using that anonymous money, but you've got to make the case.
Dennis Goldford with us, and we will focus on judicial retention, that vote, when we come back in the second half hour. A few minutes left of this half hour with Dennis Goldford. Dennis, I wanted to ask you about highlights for you. When you look across the country, in Iowa, outside of Iowa, what are the races that most interest you that are bellwethers that will have 2010 written all over them for you?
Well, certainly the major political phenomenon in this cycle has been the Tea Party. I think a political party, and we'll see this among the Democrats, but since the Republicans were essentially coming back from the depths over the past cycle, I can point to them as an example. A political party can usually give three reasons for a series of electoral defeats, one of which it never will. The first is to say, well, we didn't get our message out. We didn't communicate very well. The second argument they can make, which they won't, is that, oh, we got our message out all right. The public simply rejected it. No party's going to say that. So the third move, and this is what where the Tea Party came from, and whether lesser extent in Iowa, more in Nevada, more in Kentucky, more in New Jersey, is to say we lost because we weren't true enough to our principles. So on the Republican side, they were saying we lost because we weren't conservative enough. And so they assumed a kind of circle the wagons and burn the heretics mode. They went after members of their own party they thought were insufficiently conservative. And so I think that's the most striking thing about this particular cycle. What's interesting in Iowa is that Terry Branstad is certainly a conservative politician. He's not a liberal, but he's a pragmatic conservative, more of a centrist conservative, something that the other side, the other camp in the primaries, really wasn't very happy about. But he's triumphed in a sense. His victory is a bit of a triumph of, say, more of a centrist kind of conservatism than the more radical kind of populist conservatism that's dominated around the country, as in the case of the Tea Party.
Terry Branstad as centrist, but also when you
mentioned, centrist conservative,
conservative. But when we look back at his campaign, we have to remember he was endorsed by Tea Party darling Sarah Palin.
If he you received recall that.
Yes, go ahead.
I mean, if you recall, at least I saw the video when he was sort of handed this endorsement. He was at a campaign stop, and he just started chuckling as though this came out of nowhere and I didn't really need this. So, you know, that's a case she may want to associate herself with his victory, but this was his victory independently of her.
Mm-hmm. But also looking down the road to 2012, Sarah Palin spoken a lot of as a potential bid for the White House. Terry Branstad endorsing Sarah Palin. Can you picture that?
Governor Branstad, and I didn't get a chance to ask him before the show, but Governor Branstad in the past has generally remained relatively neutral among caucus candidates and caucus competitors. I would be surprised if he actually came out and endorsed somebody, but I've been surprised before, so we'll have to wait and see.
As I said, we'll talk more about judge retention, that issue on the ballot in our second half hour. Dennis Goldford, we have a couple minutes before we end this segment and then talk with Bob Vanderplaats as well as Frank Carroll, president of the Iowa State Bar Association, to get their opinions on this. Would you mind setting this up for us, this judge retention issue? Put it in some context, what both sides were asking for in this case.
Well, the folks on the Vanderplaats side who opposed retention of these Supreme Court justices were at least in theory making a relatively principled point that the judges in their view, the justices of the Iowa Supreme Court in their view, had gone beyond their legitimate interpretive powers and reached out and made a decision which, in the view of the Vanderplaats folks, was not justified by Iowa, the Iowa Constitution, and Iowa tradition. And so they, in their view, were making use of a procedure that's there, they didn't sort of in out of nowhere, for judicial retention to send a message to the judiciary. Their ads said, for example, that the justices were not listening to the will of the voters.
And quickly, the other side, before we have to take a break?
The other side's argument is it's not the purpose of judges to listen to the will of the voters. It's the purpose of judges to listen to and interpret law. And their view is if you don't like the decision, change the law.
Okay.
Don't go after the judges.
Dennis Goldford, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, our analyst today for the day after the 2010 election. When we come back, we'll talk with Bob Vanderplaats. He'll tell us about his campaign, successful campaign to oust three Iowa Supreme Court justices. Also, Frank Carroll, president of the Iowa State Bar Association. We want to hear from you. What is your view on the ousting of these three Iowa Supreme Court justices? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Back in just a few minutes with
support
more of The Exchange.
Support comes from the UI School of Music.
Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. And this day after the 2010 midterm election, and we're dissecting them with some analysis and conversation, the implications of this midterm vote. Dennis Goldford with us, political science professor at Drake University in our studios at Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. And we'd like to reach out to you. What is your view on the ousting of three Iowa Supreme Court justices? That's what we want to focus on, at least the first part of this half hour. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. If you've not followed it, yesterday, three Iowa Supreme Court justices failed to receive the 50% vote needed to retain their offices. former Republican gubernatorial candidate Bob Vanderplaats organized a campaign to oust the justices, based largely on their participation in a unanimous ruling that paved the way for same-sex marriage in the state of Iowa. Bob Vanderplaats joins me now by phone to discuss the result. Hello, Mr. Vanderplaats. Welcome to our program.
Well, it's always good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I said that your campaign was based largely on the same-sex marriage ruling. Were there other issues, or was that the only one that led to this non-retention vote?
Well, the case that we really focused on was the Varnum versus Breen opinion that was handed out on April 3, 2009. And we just thought it clearly illustrated an activist court that chose to make law from the bench, who chose to execute their opinion from the bench, and who chose to really amend the Constitution from the bench. And so therefore we saw a danger to all of our freedoms when that takes place. So we launched a campaign to not retain these three justices. And last night, Iowans overwhelmingly agreed with us.
Mm-hmm. You said amend the Constitution from the bench. They would say they were interpreting the Constitution, not only these three judges, but the other four judges in this unanimous seven-justice ruling. Your campaign repeatedly talked about the role of courts in our system of government and what that proper role of courts is. Given last night's results, what is now the role of the judiciary? You've said what you believe it is not. What is the role of the judiciary? How would you define that?
Well, I think what it is, it's what it's always been. But they have to stay within their constitutional bounds. For example, they cite, and when I debated former Supreme Court justices, they would cite Article 12.1 of the Iowa Constitution. In Article 12.1, the Iowa Constitution gives the Supreme Court authority to void legislation that they interpret to be unconstitutional. And I fully grant them that. However, the second sentence of Article 12.1 clearly states that the legislature will enact all law to carry out the intent of this Constitution. So if they deem legislation unconstitutional, as they did with the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed in 1998, what they should have done at that point, that's where their role stopped. Then they should have thrown it back to the legislature, and the legislature would have had a couple of options. Either codify same-sex marriage into law, or say, you know what, this is too big of an issue, throw it to the people of Iowa, like 31 other states have done, for a vote for a constitutional amendment. And so what happened here is that you had a court that just simply went outside of its bounds, saying Iowa will be a same-sex marriage state. All 99 counties will follow suit. They didn't limit its ruling to the parties involved. They extrapolated the ruling to all 99 counties. They said they were going to interpret the Constitution or hold up the Constitution to an evolving standard with every generation. And they were going to hand out rights that were never imagined by the founders. Those just, quite frankly, are not their roles.
Judges and justices make decisions, some more or less popular with the general public. Does this mean, in your opinion, that judges and justices should be relieved of their duties any time they make an unpopular decision?
No, absolutely not. They should be relieved of their duties as they were last night when they step outside of their jurisdiction, when they step over the line. Much the same way when Governor Tom Vilsack tried to make law from the bench a couple of times, and when he did that, both times he got sued, and both times he got sued, he got defeated because a governor cannot make law from the bench either. So as long as they stay within their constitutional bounds, they're okay. It's when they go outside of it that they need to be worried.
This retention election went in the direction that you pushed for, that you campaigned for, but same-sex marriage remains the law of the land in this state of Iowa today. What do you hope to be the next step in this campaign against same-sex marriage in the state?
Well, it's not just what Bob Vanderplaats hopes for. I think it's what you see what the majority of Iowans hope for. They had a referendum last night on failed leadership. Failed leadership at the governor's office, failed leadership in the legislature, failed leadership in the courts, and they replaced court members, they ousted court members. they replaced the legislature and they replaced the governor. What they want today is leadership. And I think they're going to expect leadership out of the newly elected legislature as well as out of the newly elected governor to restore marriage to mean one man and one woman, or to give the people of Iowa a voice on this issue.
You've been the point man, the initiator of this campaign. What will your role be in the continued same-sex marriage debate in Iowa?
I'm going to continue to be a voice. I've told people all along I am not going away. I'm going to stay in this fight for liberty, for our state, for our country. It's something that I take very, very seriously, and I'm glad I get the opportunity to be a voice. I consider it a great privilege, so I'll continue to be a voice.
Now, just speaking with Governor Terry Branstad, Governor-elect Terry Branstad, you told him that you thought this campaign would also put pressure on him as the governor to issue an executive order to stay this ruling until Iowans could vote on a constitutional amendment. He says he doesn't even have that power to do that. How do you react to the fact that Terry Branstad doesn't seem to be inclined to do anything?
Well, I look forward to having a visit with Governor-elect Branstad, sitting it down and taking a look at what his role is from the executive branch. I think now what he sees after last night is that there's been a moral majority, so to speak, and he at least needs to be open to listen. Mm-hmm. I think in the Constitution, Article 4.1 says that being governor, he's the chief magistrate, and the chief magistrate does have the responsibility to hold other branches of the government in check as well. And so when a court's made an opinion that isn't theirs to make, or they make law that isn't theirs to make, I believe he has that authority to hold them in check, and I look forward to that discussion with him.
A lot of talk about outside money in campaigns, not just in the judicial retention, but in other races during this midterm election. Where did the money come from for this campaign against the retention of these judges?
You know, it came from a variety of sources. Matter of fact, I've been involved in a lot of campaigns, as you might recall. It's been one of the most organic campaigns I've ever been involved with, whether it was American Family Action that got involved, or the National Organization of Marriage, or Citizen Link, or the Iowa Family Policy Center Action, or Steve King, or David Hartsuch, or literally thousands of Iowans who came and got involved and engaged in this campaign. So the money came from a variety of sources, both in-state and out-of-state. But this campaign was led by Iowans. It was chaired by an Iowan, by me. And this election was voted on by Iowans, and Iowans had their voice heard.
Thank you very much, Bob Vanderplaats, joining us live. Sioux City businessman and former Republican gubernatorial candidate. He's led the successful campaign to vote no on the retention of three Iowa Supreme Court justices. Bob Vanderplaats, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And if you'd like to weigh in on the ousting of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And joining me now to discuss this judicial retention vote further is Frank Carroll, president of the Iowa State Bar Association. Hello, Mr. Carroll.
Hi.
What is your reaction to the results of this retention vote?
Well, I think that everybody, well, everybody, at least the Bar Association, is extremely disappointed with the results, and are very concerned about what it may have as far as future ramifications on the judicial system.
Mm-hmm. You were listening, no doubt, to Bob Vanderplaats talk.
Yes, I
there.
Was.
He said, you know, when justices step out of their jurisdiction, as he said it, out of bounds, the voters have the right to vote them out of office. Is he incorrect in that?
Well, I would think I would differ with him on that point. The justices take an oath to uphold and defend the Iowa Constitution as well as the United States Constitution. And in that capacity, when a case comes before them, and it's not a case they just sort of they make up. I mean, it is an actual litigated case, and it comes before the Supreme Court. They really don't have any choice. They have to look at the statute that was passed by the legislature and determine whether or not that statute is constitutional or unconstitutional. And that's what they did. I mean, they didn't have any real choice. They had to make their decision. And the fact that it was a unanimous decision by justices that had been appointed by both the Republicans and Democrats, I think really lends to the credibility of the of their decision.
Let's get Amy in on the discussion here. Amy is in Urbandale. Good afternoon, Amy. What do you think of this vote, no, on judicial retention?
I'm just really disappointed in Iowans for doing this. You know, the judicial system is supposed to be a check on legislature. It shouldn't have to go with what's popular. I'm sure in the 50s that Brown versus Board of Education would have been voted out if it was put before the voters, but that doesn't mean that it was an important decision. I think that the judicial system is there to really protect the minority and protect people who aren't popular. I just think it's a bad precedent.
Amy from Urbandale, thank you very much. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And as someone who works within the legal system, Frank Carroll, president of the Iowa State Bar Association, what are your concerns about how the results of this vote may impact the judiciary in Iowa?
Well, one of the concerns that that we have is whether or not it's going to set a precedent for politically influenced big money, out-of-state money, being used in future retention elections. That type of a precedent would drastically change the judicial system that we've had in Iowa.
So how would it do that? So you're a judge sitting on a bench, has a controversial issue. Now you have to factor in the political ramifications in the next retention vote. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that the Iowa courts have consistently been is fair and impartial. As you may know, they're almost always consistently ranked in the top five by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as being fair and impartial. And one of the things that has led to that is the merit selection system. And if we now introduce big money campaigns into the retention election, it surely could give the impression that it would affect the decisions, if not in actuality affect the decisions. And then, you know, over and above that, with that type of big money involved in retention elections, it certainly could affect the quality of lawyers that would be willing to serve as judges in the future.
In closing here with you in this discussion, Frank Carroll, the statement issued by the three justices ousted in this retention election said, and I quote, "Finally, we hope Iowans will continue to support Iowa's merit selection system for appointing judges. This system helps ensure that judges base their decisions on the law and the Constitution and nothing else. Ultimately, however, the preservation of our state's fair and impartial courts will require more than the integrity and fortitude of individual judges. It will require the steadfast support of the people." Frank Carroll, are you confident that there is steadfast support of the people for Iowa's merit system of selecting judges?
Yes, I am. I think this was a very unique combination of events with this retention election. And I think, and I'm hoping and thinking that with respect to future retention elections, that the people in Iowa will be very proud and supportive of the merit selection process.
Frank Carroll, president of the Iowa State Bar Association, thank you for spending time with us.
Well, thank you very much.
This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. If you have a view on this, we want to hope to get to a couple phone calls, 1-866-780-9100. Dennis Goldford with us, political science professor at Drake University. What do you see, before we quickly go to a few calls on this, what do you see as the significance of this judge retention no vote?
Well, angry people vote, and courts sometimes make decisions that distress a lot of people. And in a sense, the justices were pushed into a box by the anti-folks that was very clever. Because if the justice's argument was that this would politicize the judiciary to be electorally accountable for particular decisions, but if they were to make a political campaign out of that to stay in office, they were falling into doing the kind of politics that they said their purpose was to avoid. So they got put in a very cleverly constructed box.
This is an interesting comment from Donald on Facebook. He writes about the ousting of the justices. He says he's disappointed and wondering if Governor Culver, who is our governor until January, should attempt to appoint successors to the Supreme Court since he can legally do this.
That would certainly cause, I think, more than a tempest in a teapot. Yes, he is legally governor until he leaves office in January. The commission would take a certain amount of time to get together and consider the possibility of nominees. And I believe you need three for each judgeship, so you'd need a total of nine in this particular case. It would be a lot to do in a fairly constricted period of time. But politically, that would raise a huge howl of protest from a lot of folks who say, basically, you're on your way out. This should be something done by the incoming governor. And in fact, some Democrats might want to say that given that they likely would have supported Governor Culver against incoming Governor Branstad, they might want to say, go ahead and put it on Governor Branstad. Let him deal with it and take the heat.
Let's swing back to the implications for the national races before we have to end this hour, about 5 minutes left, with Dennis Goldford, political science professor at Drake University. With the GOP takeover of the House in a big way, something like 60 seats, the Republicans, their new Tea Party people in office, how is this a game changer in Washington overall? How do you see that?
Well, in a sense, you know, there's that old phrase, be careful what you wish for. Republicans were solidly in opposition in Washington, as they were solidly in opposition here in Iowa. They controlled none of the branches of government here, nor in Washington. So Republicans could take it as their particular job simply to slow down or stop those policies and programs the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress thought were important to enact for the country. Now that they will control the House of Representatives, and they've certainly had filibuster power in the Senate, they share responsibility. So this can enable them to construct an agenda that they want to campaign on in 2012. At the same time, President Obama now has a more focused enemy than the herding cats he had to engage in with his own Democratic Party. He could, in theory at least, depending upon what the Republicans do, run against a Republican Congress the way Harry Truman did in 1948.
Mm-hmm. So it would be do you expect then in the next 2 years that there will be gridlock or more bipartisan cooperation, compromise, as we saw in after the midterm election during Bill Clinton's time?
Right. That's where the Republican caucus has to negotiate their differences within that caucus, because as we talked about earlier, many of these Tea Party folks came in because they thought that the Republican establishment was not conservative enough. And it was rank heresy, political, if not religious, to cooperate with, much less negotiate with and compromise with the other side. So it's a question of whether the Republican leadership finds a way to work with the Tea Party types, whose mantra is against any kind of compromise, and yet politics is all about compromise. So that's where the question of gridlock will be focused, not so much between the Republicans and Democrats as within the Republican caucus itself.
But quickly, before we have to go, what about the state of the Republican Party in Iowa, in the Iowa legislature, with their victory in the Iowa House of Representatives? Give us an idea of how that changes the game at our state level.
Well, you know, there's a kind of spiral upward or a spiral downward. We saw that this year. When you think your party is going to do well, better prospective candidates decide they'll throw their hat in the ring and take a chance. They're rational actors. They don't want to participate in a losing effort. So the better you think your party is doing or will do, the better the candidate you get. Conversely, the worse you think your party is likely to do, the better people may say, oh, I'm going to wait till next time. And you saw many more Republican seats contested this time than Democratic seats in the Iowa House. The Republicans contested 93 of the 100 seats. Democrats contested only 74, I believe, of the seats in the House. So the Republicans are on the upswing. That will encourage more Republicans to believe they've got a good chance to be electorally successful in 2012. We won't have a statewide race, but we will, interestingly, have new races. This race yesterday was the last election in which all of our legislative officials, federal and state, will run in those districts. We will have the redistricting. It's new terrain next time around, but this may well encourage a lot of Republicans to consider running in 2012.
Dennis Goldford, thank you very much this hour. Let's leave with these words from a tweet from Nolan. Nolan says, I'm worried that the divisions in politics will just deepen and less will get done, both on the state and federal level. Thank you for all the input we've had from listeners. Dennis Goldford, thank you for being at our side to provide some analysis. Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Professor Goldford, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. We also had help in Des Moines from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.